another episode of Mention and Dispatches here. We're in the middle of season 7. Folks that have been listening for a couple of weeks know that I've completely lost count of what number episode we're on. I think it's 9, but don't hold me to that. And we've got a full house tonight. Joining me as a fill-in co-host, our buddy Chris Weave is back. Chris, how you doing tonight?
I am doing pretty good, everything considering.
Yeah, outstanding. And then we have with us the Doctor's Wits, Aaron and Austin, who are the design team behind Robotech Reconstruction. So, Aaron, welcome.
Thank you.
And Austin, welcome.
Happy to be here.
So it's a big crowd here. We are obviously going to talk a bunch about the Robotech Reconstruction design from the guys here. Before we get too far into that, earlier in the season, Chris had let us know about what was going on with Winchell Chung and the unfortunate medical diagnosis there. But Chris is taking over the Atomic Rockets website from Winchell. And so, Chris, I know there hadn't been a ton of movement. Where are we at this point with Atomic Rockets, and what can people expect to see kind of between now and the end of the year, if much?
So I'm not expecting people to see much between now and the end of the year, because there's a combination of things going on. First of all, I'm taking things kind of slow, right? I'm trying to be very methodical. Winch has basically handed me his legacy, and I'm very aware of that. I'd be very hesitant to make any major muscle movements to start off with, even if it wasn't for the fact that Winchell's somebody I've known for a long time and have a great deal of respect for. So from that standpoint, I'm not rushing out and doing anything. I'm also, the other big piece of it is I'm working on my infrastructure behind the scenes. I had a long list of things I needed to do from like a hardware perspective and sort of getting my online life together. And I've decided now's the good time to do that, because I, for a while, have had some plans about things that I wanted to do to complement Atomic Rockets, going back to the creation of that website, because I was not quite standing in the room when he created it, but I was right next door. And so I want to make sure that I sort of think all that through and I set things up for success in the future. The default plan is still, I think, what I outlined previously, which is my intent, unless Winchell tells me he wants me to do something else, is that there'll be like a legacy website that'll sort of be like, this is what Winch did. And then that one will be there as sort of my own little Internet Archive version of that. In fact, I might actually talk to the Internet Archive about hosting it. And then there'll be one going forward that will sort of continue to expand the work. Winch made the comment to me at one point that he's got like 20 years worth of stuff in his backlog, and he's given all that stuff to me. So I haven't had a chance to fully inventory it. That's one of the next steps, is to sort of figure out exactly what I've got, to talk to the guy who wrote the code that Winch is using for the website now, and sort of make sure that I can sort of preserve it.
At the risk of making us all feel really, really old, 20 years seems low, given that 20 years still puts us in the 21st century.
Yeah, it's probably, I for some reason, the date 1994 sticks out in my mind. I don't think it's quite that old, because I remember sort of, you know, it's got to be getting close, but so that website in some very important ways came out of SF Consomel, the science fiction war games list, of which I'm the founder. And I frequently said that if I got to pick what would be on my epitaph, you know, the epitaph of my tombstone, it would be founder SF Consomel. Despite all the other stuff I've done, that's the thing that I would sort of point to, because that is more than just a wargaming website. That's a website, like, you go through Atomic Rockets and you see all these people quoted in Atomic Rockets. A lot of those are directly taken from conversations on SF Consomel.
Yeah.
That's where he got that information. And so if I remember correctly, I started SF Consomel in about 97. And so before Atomic Rockets showed up on the website, Winch had the cartography website, the stellar cartography piece of it.
Yep.
And he also had the nomogram piece of it. Those two came first, and then he added Atomic Rockets on top of that.
Yeah. And so for folks that aren't hugely familiar with Atomic Rockets, this is hard sci-fi with a bit of a military and consim bent, and has been very influential and inspirational to a lot of writers whose names you know and who you can walk into Barnes & Noble right now and pick up books from, as well as a variety of game designers over the years, both digital and tabletop. And so you know, atomic rockets as a resource has been around for a long time and been very helpful to a lot of folks. I think the Expanse was one you'd mentioned in the past, yeah. Chris, but I certainly the Honorverse guys, you know, David Weber and the BU-9 crew that you've been a part of forever. Those guys have all used that as a reference along the way.
Yeah, there's a lot of really good stuff on that website. I mean, it's hard science focused. Winch was really into the physics and the science and the engineering piece of it with, you know, some stuff about how you do things in space, maybe some, let's call it doctrine to go along with it. But he was really sort of focused on the science side of things. I said that there was complementary stuff that I'm interested in doing. My thing is more along the lines of doctrine and tactics and that piece of it, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah,
Winch is the person you would talk to find out about, you know, what type of rocket engine you should have. I'm the guy who you'd talk to about, given a particular set of engineering constraints, what does your command and control system look like? For instance, I do a talk at science fiction conventions called Naval Command and Control. And it basically, one of the things I do in that is I make the argument that the U.S. Navy's composite warfare commander system would work really, really well in Jack Campbell's Lost Fleet universe, because the sorts of things that the Russians used to do with jamming is very close to the things that Blackjack Geary has to deal with regards to light speed lag and things like that. I mean, they both function to decrease the ability of the commander to get information in a timely manner. And so approaching it the same way would make sense. So I'm a command and control guy, and I'm sort of a doctrine guy and kill chain guy, et cetera, which is not where Winch put his intellectual effort. So I've always thought that I needed to do a companion to that website. And now I'm in a situation.
Now you've got the chance to do it. Yeah. Now you get the chance to do that. So, all right. So folks, you know, keep an eye on the site as Chris slowly starts to evolve this thing. And we're going to see, you know, what comes out of that and the contributors that he's bringing on board there. But look, knowing the people behind it, you know, it's going to be pretty well thought out in the sci-fi world.
I feel obligated to point out, as I always do when I'm on YouTube, that the opinions expressed by me are the opinions expressed by me and not any employer, past, present, or future. To the best of my knowledge, my employer does not have an opinion about any of these topics. The deal I have with them is they don't speak for me and I don't speak for them. So,
and yeah, we got to make sure we get that disclaimer in there with Chris, given that he comes from the professional wargaming world. So had to make sure we snuck that in. With that, we're going to take a turn off of atomic rockets. We're going to get to Aaron and Austin talking to us about Robotech Reconstruction. And guys, I'll tell you, just, you know, poking around some on the game and looking into it once we had set up this interview and this podcast episode, one of the things that I got a real kick out of is I saw at least two different reviews of Robotech Reconstruction referencing the asymmetric nature of the players and talking about how this was a sci-fi version of Root without ever mentioning Volko's coin system that Root completely was inspired by. Have we just completely lost the connection back to the coin system among your audience, or what's going on here? Austin, what's happening with this?
I don't think so. I think the way that Aaron and I talk about Robotech Reconstruction, we always liken it back to the coin system more so than the Root system, because if you're coming at the game thinking that it's like Root but different, you're going to be far more confused than if you're coming at it from the coin system and saying, oh, it's like coin but different, and they're like, oh, okay, this makes a lot more sense in one context versus the other. I think what's really happening though is that comparatively, Root is a much just, it's a larger game. It's hit a larger fan base. You know, they've had a lot more, you know, they've had a ton of little mini expansions for the base system. It's a little bit more well known, but
it's easier to find in your local game store than the coin games are.
And
depending on where you're going, of course.
Yeah. And plus, I mean, part of people who look at this game are Robotech fans, and they may not have that background in wargaming. So the game they're more familiar with is Root. So they don't know yet the Trout and Coin games. To them, Root is their experience, and so that's part of it as well. But hopefully, we're drawing them more towards playing some of those classics in the Coin series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always fun trying to teach the game to I teach the game the same way, no matter how people are coming to it. But it's always funny that I've adapted my teaching style in a particular way specifically for people who have played other coin games, because this game does do things a little differently. So I reiterate some points just to try to, you know, make sure that it's like, no, this is different. This is different. But if you're coming at it completely fresh, you're like, why are you repeating this thing three times? This seems fine to me. I don't understand.
Yeah. Well, and look, obviously, like the Armchair Dragoon's background is in the wargaming world. Some of us were around at the beginning of the coin games. The short version of the story that I've told before, I was working on a project at the National Defense University, one of my brief forays into the professional wargaming world. And we were doing a thing for the International Combating Terrorism Fellows up there. And the scenario that we were working on was the drug war in Colombia. And we're up there at Connections. And here comes Volko for game night at Connections. And he's dropping Andean Abyss on that. Now, Andean Abyss was still a year from publication at this point. Volko drops Andean Abyss on the table. And we're standing around going, God damn it. What's he doing? Bringing it. He's doing all the same stuff we are. He's just making it look better. And so our whole design for the Columbia thing suddenly got a whole lot more notes scribbled onto it after seeing what Volko had done with Andy. Now, what we were doing was a very different approach for Andy than Andy and Abyss, because the professional guys care a lot more about certain things than the casual players do. And because we also had 80 people involved in the game where, you know, a coin game seats four. And so no matter how you slice it, we had a far more complex problem to solve. But you know, some of us have seen those things since the beginning and followed them a lot. And it's cool to see that they've drawn in non-traditional war game fans, folks that you wouldn't normally get playing war games. A lot of Twilight Struggle and Labyrinth players have crossed over into the coin world. You've been able to bring in some less groggy, hardcore war game types into those coin games. And that's kind of cool, right? You want to expand the pie some. So it's interesting to see how you guys take those influences and run with them.
Well, and we've been very conscious of that, because we, in this game design, we've been working very hard at making it accessible to coin players, especially if they haven't played Robotech. So we've made sure that this design is enjoyable if you don't know Robotech. We purposely kept one of the designers in this design process not to have watched the Robotech series to make sure they still had fun playing the game.
Yeah. And that would be Aaron, the one who's talking now.
And then we've also been very conscious that a lot of the Robotech fans have not played a coin game before.
Yeah.
And so we've been very conscious about trying to make this as accessible as we can for them, because we're not being published by GMT Game. We're not an official coin game. We're coin inspired. And so a lot of people who our publisher traditionally works with do not have that background. And we have to really make sure that we're putting it together in a way that they can pick it up. And so we're very conscious about accessibility because of that as well.
So it's an interesting Venn diagram overlap there.
You know, since you've related your coin story, I'd like to relate mine as well. I have a little mini one as well. So when I was in college, my girlfriend at the time was a foreign relations major, and she was doing a paper on the FARC conflict, and she had me like review the paper, you know, and see if there's grammatical notes, whatever. And I read through it and then made my notes and gave it back to her. And I'm like, this is a really interesting conflict. I think there's a game here. A game can be made out of this. So I do a little searching of like, what kind of games have already been made on it? And it's all this kind of hex and counter stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but that's not really what I was reading in the paper, because it's way more complicated than that. I spent like 5 minutes on it and I'm like, it's impossible. No, there's no way anybody can make a game out of this, right? Especially not the way it's supposed to be done. So of course, to my shock, like 5 or 6 years later when Andean Abyss comes out, and I'm like, oh my God, the madmen actually did it and it's good. Holy cow. I can't believe it. And been following the coin series ever since. It's quite a feat.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's fun in that it is asymmetric and yet still as well balanced as it can be. And that's a hard thing to do, as you guys well know from this. So help catch up the audience that may not be so obviously, you know, you've mentioned you've got the coin guys on one side of the room and the Robotech guys on the other side of the room, and we got to figure out how they all meet in the middle. Our side of the room is mostly those wargaming coin types. Help catch them up on where we are in the Robotech story, the short version of how we got here in the in-game narrative, and kind of where the game picks up in that story.
But, and that's for the narrative's important, right? Because usually if you're into coin, you're into the historical narrative. And when this design was started, we didn't start off saying that we were going to make a game inspired by Coin. Austin watched the series and he said, this is a
hey, there's a game here.
Yeah.
There's a game here because you're watching the series. And okay, so for the broad context, Robotech is a television show in the United States. In Japan, it's one season Robotech. Super Defense Force Macross is what they called it in Japan. When they brought it over to the States, they took Super Defense Force Macross and they took two other shows and they combined them all together into one three season show called that they called Robotech. And of course, there's a whole lot of other backstory to that. You'll get all these things because like some things were changed over in the English translation. So we'll be presenting this stuff and people will like, oh, they're using the fake names. Okay, cool. And but this game takes place at the end during the last 9 episodes of the first season of Robotech, or the very last 9 episodes of the Super Defense Force Macross show that has been translated into English. And to set the ground, we have just come out of the first Robotech war. Now, of course, okay, they call it the first Robotech war, so you know there's going to be more. But for right now,
they call it the first Robotech war in the show? Like, were they already planning on a sequel?
Call
it the Robotech war, kind of like the Great War wasn't World War I until there was a two.
Exactly. Like, at the time, it's not the first Robotech war, but today we call it the first Robotech
war. All right.
And I do want to hit upon this one thing that does link Coin with Robotech in the sense that Robotech as a series, even though it's been around since the early 80s, it's one of those shows that has not had a massive reboot, has not had like a whole canonical diversion in it like you get with some other very long-running sci-fi properties. And so what you get with Robotech is like, yes, there's supplementary material. You know, there's a whole book series that's out there, mm-hmm. right? Now, for our purposes, we can't use the book series. We're still tied to the show IP. So like all that stuff you read in the book. But here's the thing. The stuff you read in the book tries to connect and fill in the gaps of the show. It doesn't break away from it. It's just that we can't use it. So all of the supplemental material really treats Robotech as a historical thing. And we wanted to treat it as seriously as everybody else who has had their hands on this property. And so we're now 2 years out from the first Robotech war. It is the far, far future of 2013. And what has happened is that during that war, you have the alien Zentradi force. That's a warrior race that has been bred and born for combat. And they've been after the SDF-1, the named ship, the thing that the show is named after in Japan. And the whole series, these aliens have been trying to capture this ship and not destroy it, even though the humans think that they're trying to destroy it and they're daftly defending their ship from being destroyed. While the aliens are like, well, they didn't fall for that trap. Let's retreat back. We'll try again. We'll try to capture this thing.
So why do the humans have the SDF-1, Austin?
No, I was trying to keep this brief. Okay, so.
Look, if you tell the story of Robotech, this is a 3-part podcast.
Right, yeah. This could take a little bit. Basically, the short version is an alien ship crashes on Earth. The Earthlings come together and are like, what the heck is this thing? They spend 10 years rebuilding it, reformatting it. And then 10 years later, after they finally get the thing online, the aliens show up to take the thing back. And that's when the humans escape from Earth to Pluto. And the whole series is them coming back to Earth, being chased by the aliens and Trotty. Now, once we get back to the Earth, they then, even though they've been out in space for this whole time, once they get back to Earth, they have to like deal with EarthGov and whatnot. But where we are now, the first Robotech war was essentially the aliens and Trotty saying, you know what? We are fed up with trying to capture this ship. We're just going to destroy the Earth. We're just going to kill everyone. And we're just going to, you know, that's just going to be it. We're going to finish this. And the And right before we start Robotech Reconstruction, or 2 years before we start, because there's a time gap, you have the first Robotech War, which is the SDF-1 and the Robotech Defense Force, the heroes of the show, defending the Earth against the aliens and Trotty, attacking both the SDF-1 and bombarding the planet at the same time. Now, during this time, crucially, some Zentradi have actually defect against their leaders because they're like, no, this is stupid. We still want, you know, we are actually going to now help the Earthlings because they understand the cool tech that's on this ship. And they're able to prevent the complete destruction of the Earth. Now, 90% of the Earth gets destroyed, but that 10% survives, and we call that a win. And in the process,
10% nobody wants to, right? Like the loot, you know.
That's the thing. Like the coast. Like there's a couple different maps that you can find for the art. Like when they were doing the RPG for it, of like how much and where the Earth was destroyed. Yes, it's a lot of coastal cities. It's a lot of high population areas get bombarded. Of
probably
course.
Like Boise survived, right? Places nobody wants to be.
Put a pin in that. We'll come back to that. So what happens is the SDF-1 is able to save the day, but the ship itself is highly damaged and it crash lands in like Alberta, Canada, kind of in the North America region. And then we pick up 2 years later. And this is where our game begins. What you now have is 2 years of the Robotech Defense Force working hard to stabilize the atmosphere, get the water cycle back up, get the nitrogen cycle back up, replanting trees. And because most of the high civilian populated areas were destroyed, using the technology from the ship to actually rehabilitate the planet and try to get the survivors back up on their feet. And after 2 years of that, there's one other part about this, is that not all of the Zentradi were defeated in the war. In fact, a whole lot of them, defected to the humans, to the side of the humans, or a whole bunch of them crash landed on the planet and have actually now started to take up a civilian life amongst the other humans that were either there or also had come off the ship at the time. But of course, for the Zentradi, civilian life is a novel thing for them. They've always been part of a military structure. So like civilian life is a little trying. And so when you play the game as the Robotech Defense Force, your goal is to actually keep these Zentradi civilians content as civilians. Yeah. Because the last thing that you want to do is have an uprising on your hands, which brings us to the second faction of Robotech Reconstruction, which is the Zentradi Rebellion. The Zentradi Rebellion is led by Commander Chiron, who is one of the commanders of the Zentradi forces, who for the entire time of the show was always the one guy going, why are we trying to capture this ship? Let's just destroy this ship. Come on, command people above me. Let me destroy this ship. They never let him, but you know, he still follows orders. But now we're in a situation where he has crash landed on Earth and he's been hiding out for the last 2 years. And he's effectively the highest ranking commander left amongst the Zentradi. And his spies have been telling him that there is discontent amongst the civilian population. So he's like, all right, it is time to rise back up. It's time to get these Zentradi civilians back on our side, get them back into fighting force, and we're going to finish the job that we started 2 years ago. We're going to enslave these humans. We're going to take over the planet. And so when you play as them, when you play as the Zentradi Rebellion, your whole job is to get out and get these civilians, Zentradi civilians, onto your side and actually get them into your army. So when you're looking at the coin analogy, you have concepts of civilian support, and either they're supporting the government factions or they're supporting the rebellion factions. But in this game, there are literal pieces on the board that represent civilians. And if you are the rebellion, you can take those civilians off of a little track and they become members of your army, pieces that you can then use to continue to cause mayhem and take territory.
So now
we're going to talk about our third faction, which is the Anti-Unification League. And the Anti-Unification League is a group of Zentradi human civilians who for the last 2 years have been underneath military control from the RDF. Because as the RDF has been doing what they can to bring the planet back online, they've also been kind of in control of the civilian government in the region. And when you play as the Anti-Unification League, you're trying to declare independence from the Robotech Defense Force. You're trying to exert civilian control, but not underneath a unified banner, underneath an anti-unified banner. So what you're trying to do is, in the game, we have a bunch of city territories. So there's a bunch of spaces. You got city territories and land territories. And when you play as the AUL, what you're trying to specifically do is take 5 city territories and gain control of it. So your independence movement needs to be widespread enough in order for it to actually take hold and not allow the RDF to re-exert control over your regions, right? And then we have the fourth faction. The fourth faction is those Zentradi forces that defected during the conflict, during the first Robotech War. And they still have some machinery. They still have a giant flagship that's flying around up above the Earth. And when you play as them, the thing that they know is that there are more threats coming to Earth. They may have defeated this substantially large Zentradi force in order to even survive, but they know that there are more Zentradi out there. They know that there's other threats in the universe that, if you're a fan of the show, you know they're coming, but we won't get into it here. And so for them, handled by Commander Britai, who is the guy that really defected and brought those troops with him, is that what Britai knows is that in order for Earth to face these threats, Earth needs to stay united. And from their perspective, the best people to do that is, of course, the RDF military, because they're a military organization. That completely makes sense that the military should be in charge of everything. So when you play as the Robotech Defense Force, your main thing is just worried about territorial control for the RDF. And, you know, if you can get 7 in this game, it's 7 territories, which is, you know, a vast majority of the territories. If you can get all those to be controlled by the RDF, then you will be able to solidify control, and that faction will win the game.
As Armchair Dragoons continue the 7th season of Mentioned in Dispatches, we need to take a moment to thank those Patreon supporters who pledged at the regimental patron level. So a special thank you to Patrick Mullen, Hethwill Wargames, Steelgrave, Mike Quigley, Staggerwing, Robert, Joseph Knoll, Treb Curry, Kevin Bertram, and Patrick Garrity for their support of Armchair Dragoons and helping us bring you the best wargaming content on the web. You can join our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
One of the things that this game does to help make it simpler, because we mentioned this game to be accessible to people who couldn't before, is that the win conditions are very straightforward. Now, the Anti-Unification League wants to be established enough that they are not controlled by the RDF. So as long as they control 5 cities at victory check, they have succeeded at that goal. The Robotech Defense Force wants to make sure that there's enough happy Zentradi civilians that a rebellion won't be successful. Well, as long as there's 5 happy Zentradi civilians at victory check, they've achieved their goal. The RDF wants to make sure that there's enough territory on Earth controlled by the Robotech Defense Force, that as long as the RDF Robotech Expeditionary Force is able to help them achieve that outcome, where they have 7 that they control, then they have, again, achieved their goal. And for the Zentradi Rebellion, if they can get 11 civilians to join their rebellion automatically, so there is no victory check for them, as soon as it happens in their case, they've won, game's over. Again, they've achieved their objective and they have fulfilled their goals.
All right, Chris, wanting to jump in here.
Yeah, so I've got a question here. And so you guys did an interview not too long ago, at least I don't think it was too long ago, that I read earlier, because I actually, you know, it may sound like I'm just making shit up as I go along, but I actually do try to prep a little bit for things like this. And the thing that wasn't clear to me in that interview, and actually still isn't clear to me, is it possible for both the Robotech Defense Force, the humans, and the Robotech Expeditionary Force the Zentradi to both win?
So the way the game's set up is that we have what's called a major victory and a minor victory. So the major victory is if you achieve your full objective. So if you get to the 5 Zentradi civilians as the Robotech Defense Force, you're the sole winner of the game. You achieve your major objective, you're happy. But the game only lasts 4 rounds. And after 4 rounds, if there is no major victory, then we call have what's called a minor victory. In the minor victory, 2 factions will win. So what will happen is in the minor victory, you're pitched against the person of the same race, whether you're a Zentradi or you're human. So the Robotech Defense Force is going to compare their score with the Anti-Evocation League, and whoever has the highest score will win the game between those, the minor victory, and the Zentradi Rebellion will compare their score with the Otec Expeditionary Force, and whoever's higher score in that situation will also win the game. Though the Zentradi Rebellion, the score track, if you were look at the scorecard, gets a little modified so that, let's say you had 8 people you brought off the board, that doesn't count as 8 points for them. It counts as 6 because it sort of steps up slower so that their scores are more comparable, because the top score that Robotech Expeditionary Force can earn is 7. And depending on who ties, we have automatic winners. So
between the Anti-Unification League and the Robotech Defense Force, the Anti-Unification League wins ties. And between the Robotech Expeditionary Force, which is the REF, which is Commander Britai flying around in his flagship, and Commander Chiron in the Zentradi Rebellion, the Robotech Expeditionary Force will win ties. So here's the tricky thing about this. During the entirety of the game, when you're pursuing your major victory, you are opposed to one of the other players. When you talk about the minor victory, you're actually switching the player that you have to worry about. So if you get into a minor victory mindset too soon in the game, you will probably very quickly throw the game to somebody else to have them win a major victory. And to answer the question, I think that there's actually a secondary question.
Well, I was going to say the major victory means like you have fully achieved your aims, if you want to think about this in sort of a thematic sense. And the minor victory is you didn't fully achieve your aims, but you at least have a step up in the direction you want it to go.
And it sounded like what Chris is asking is, well, what is preventing the RDF and the REF from just being buddy-buddy and working together the whole time? Well, backstabbery, seeing the opportunity to just win the game early, because that you do have to wait all the way to the end in order to have that thing pull off.
I think at that point, though, it's you guys are sort of relying on the competitive nature of the players rather than the model of the game to sort of force them to interact a certain way. And I think Chris has just been around enough contrarians in his life that he would know exactly who to put on those two sides on the table in order to make them get along.
That was part of it. The other part of it was just that the description of it talks about how the REF wants the RDF to succeed, and I had a hard time sort of differentiating them. There's a couple of games when I was first looking at this. Talk about how it's based on the coin series, etc. But the two games that immediately came to my mind are games that are about as far apart as you can get and still be in the same planet. One of them is the old SPI game Russian Civil War. Mm-hmm. Where you play both the reds and the whites. You've got factions on both the reds and the whites. And then in order for you to win the game, you have to be the dominant player on the side that wins. So like to win as the reds, you're the dominant red player, but you control some whites that can attack the other guy's reds. And the other game that immediately came to mind is the card game Bang. Okay. Which is a nice little mm-hmm. beer and pretzels game, you know, extra points if you start the game after midnight, that sort of thing. Right. But it has that function where, you know, you've got some players only win if another player wins and they get to share the victory, whereas you've got other players that are trying to prevent that. And then another type of player that has to be the last person standing. So he switches sides partway through.
Well, I will push back slightly, because even though the REF wants the Robotech Defense Force to do well, their goals and aims are different. So one, like the REF just cares about territorial control, right? So they just want to get as many territories on the map underneath RDF control. From the RDF's perspective, they don't necessarily care about that. And this is where you get into these interesting things where you kind of look back at the show. Because again, a lot of this stuff is cued in from the show, where it's very interesting that from the RDF's perspective during these, what is effectively 9 episodes or about a year's worth of time, is that the RDF doesn't really care about what the AUL is doing in the world. They're quite okay with the civilians declaring independence and taking civilian control back. They're okay with that. They're more concerned about just putting down these small armed rebellions that are popping up due to Commander Chiron. There's another tangent there, but in this game, the situation that as the RDF player will find yourself in is you're like, oh, I really need to go to this location because it's an easy way to pull up some, to pull up some support for me to make some more of these civilians happy. But if I do that, I will be giving the RDF the 7th territory that they need in order to win the game. And then I'm going to lose. So then you have to do a little maneuver dance around the board to maybe give up a territory in order to take a territory to try to make sure that your goal stays cogent factoring in the other two players on the other side of the table.
But beyond thinking just the mechanics, if you think about the goals of the institutions have different long-term objectives. The RDF isn't worried about some sort of future military invasion of Earth. The RDF is worried about some Trident connection creating some devastating civil war where a bunch of people get killed. And so that's not their focus. They're not worried about controlling the territories because that's not what's important for them to keep Centauri civilians happy. Do they sometimes take control of a territory in their efforts to influence civilians? Yes, but only because that's what they have to do to pursue their main objective. The Robotech Expeditionary Force, they're interested in a different thing. They're more worried about future wars with outside powers. And so when they're thinking about that board, they want military control because to them, that's what's going to allow the RDF to be a better military when they're called upon to fight again. And that's just not something the RDF themselves are worrying about. And so that's how you see these conflicts, right? The RDF wants the RDF to do something, but it's not necessarily the thing that RDF wants to do for themselves. Yeah. And that's the key thing in the narrative, right? You see the same thing with the AUL and the Zentradi Rebellion. You know, the AUL isn't trying to help the Zentradi Rebellion, but the Zentradi Rebellion benefits from the sort of chaos the AUL creates in their efforts to create their independent cities. And so we use the terms half allies, half enemies. And you also see it in the game mechanics, because there are things that the REF can do as actions, the Robotech Expeditionary Force, when Robotech Defense Force and them both control a territory, because they both units add up to controlling a territory for the Robotech Defense Force. And that's also true for the Centauri Rebellion and the Anti-Unification League. Both their units count towards control towards the Anti-Unification League with territory. And when the Anti-Unification League controls the territory, it opens up actions that can be useful for both sides, but it comes with risks, right? We Austin highlighted that if the RDF gets too many territories under their control, it will position the Robotech Expeditionary Force to really focus the future of Earth about defense versus from an outside invader versus the simmering tensions between trying to incorporate these two different societies together as one society. Now, if the Anti-Unification League is not careful, their efforts to destabilize Robotech Defense Force can be too successful, because then that positions the Centauri Rebellion to rise up and take over the Earth. And so it's this balancing act that you become conscious that you have to be aware of other people's objectives, where sometimes it's going to help you, but sometimes if you help them too much, it's going to prevent you from reaching what your goal is for the society of Earth. And that's where you don't just see people pairing up, because, you know, if I take too much control as the Anti-Evocation League, then it becomes really easy for the Zentradi Rebellion to get enough civilians to take out humanity and rise to the top. If I'm the Robotech Expeditionary Force, if I'm not careful about how I'm supporting Robotech Defense Force control of territories, in essence, the Robotech Defense Force can become so focused on their own goals that they aren't going to be preparing for a future war. They're just going to be too busy meddling with civilian affairs and not thinking enough about military affairs.
So it sounds like it's like most asymmetric games. It's not just enough to be building towards your victory condition. You've got to keep an eye on preventing everybody else from getting there as well. Which is normal for folks that are used to playing asymmetric games, whether it's, you know, the old Russian Civil War game, whether it's Battle for Baghdad, whether it's one of the coin games, whether it's the old Dune board game from way back when, whatever it may be, there's plenty of different variations on that theme that as soon as you've got more than two people around the table, it's a combination of I got to win, but I got to keep other people from winning as well. And it sounds like that's the fine line that you guys have been walking, that designers have been trying to walk for 35, 40, 50 years at this point. So.
And it's one of the first things that new players to this who have never played one of these before, they come to understand. They're like, they come into it and they're like, okay, I see what my goal is. All I'm going to do is I'm just going to drive towards that goal. And as soon as they do that, they find they lose. And then they look up and they're like, what? Oh, wait, I could have done something to stop that. Huh. Okay. So like, that's the first thing that they learn is that pursuing your goals is necessary, but you do have to pay attention to everybody else at the table.
And Austin's comment in many ways represents like the different groups of people we've been showing this game to. Because as you point out, this is a fine line that's been walked in board games for 35 years, but we're showing this to a lot of people who have not had the opportunity to play those sort of games for whatever reason, whether they... they're all great games, but... And for them, like us getting them to... some reason with the sci-fi or Robotech theme, get them to start playing this game. For them, this is their first exposure to that situation. But you're right. I mean, there's as you said, we're coin inspired because we've seen other great games do this. And also, to tell you very well, like when Austin was watching the series, he was saying, wait a second, these episodes are a counterinsurgency. These are four factions. There's a model for this type of interaction in board gaming. And if we're going to represent the show, that's what we need to be representing in this game.
Yeah, that's right. And like the funniest thing about watching the show and seeing how it's unveiling and going, wait, this is a counterinsurgency. But the funny thing about it is, of course, because this was a, you know, this was a show created in the 80s by Japanese artists and animators. There's no terminology for it. And there's no, like, the Robotech Defense Force never recognizes that they're in a counterinsurgency or that they even have to do counterinsurgency. There's a couple of scenes where your main character gets to be heroic as a main character and like convince some of these civilians to not walk off into the desert and join, you know, into the wasteland and join Chiron and his army. But besides these few scenes, the military never quite in the show, never quite gets around to doing a proper counterinsurgency. They just think that they're just putting down little fires here and there. And then when it all comes up against them, because spoiler alert, if you took this game and you put it in the show, the AUL wins. Yeah. Spoiler alert. So like the RDF doesn't even win this conflict.
Yeah. Well, Chris has seen enough of these kinds of conflicts over the years also that the fact that somebody's in the middle of a counterinsurgency and doesn't realize it isn't really that far beyond the pale. That's totally something that is believable and historically supported. A lot of our listeners will recognize the rest. Look, for a long time leading up to the global war on terror, what you always heard from the U.S. military is, we don't do counterinsurgency. And a lot of that was the scars of Vietnam. They didn't want to have to deal with counterinsurgency again. Anybody in the U.S. military that studied even, you know, a half a semester of U.S. military history, hearing somebody say, we don't do counterinsurgency, like, did you miss the last 250 years of U.S. military, like the entire frontier wars, all the banana wars around Central America, the Philippines? Like, this is not new stuff for the U.S. military. We've been doing this a long time. So for folks to pop up and go, either we don't do counterinsurgency or, oh, that's not really an insurgency. We're just clean. You know, we're just policing the area. It's like, that's what you're doing. Like, that's exactly what it is. So the idea that, you know, the show shows these guys in a counterinsurgency situation and don't realize it. Yeah, I could buy that.
I could totally buy that too.
That's not beyond the pale. That's happened plenty of times in history.
And what's even hilarious is that we haven't really talked about how the game plays out, but like the heart of the game, much like a coin game, the heart of this game is the event cards. We have a deck. It's a very small deck because, again, it's only four rounds. It's a short game. You play it through in about 2 hours. But you got these event cards that are events taken directly from the show. 90% of them are directly taken from the show. A couple of them are like, well, this is a thing that happened, and then this could mean this, and you kind of extrapolate. But most of the event cards are things that actually happened in the show. And one of the event cards for the RDF military, you show that to the RDF player, and it's called the Zentradi Relocation Act, where the RDF is able to take Zentradi civilians in other territories and pull them towards their main city. You're able to literally take the pieces and you keep them in their same alignment so they don't get happier or more disgruntled, but you're able to discontent, but you're able to bring them straight to your capital city, you know, your major city. And you show this to the RDF player and they go, why is this one of my cards? This isn't good for me. I don't understand this. And I have to say, do you want to know what? This event card is like literally the first thing that the RDF does in the show. Like as soon as they think they have a problem, the first thing they do is round up a bunch of the civilians and bring them to the capital, to like their major city. And they're like, well, that wasn't a good idea. And it's like, no, it didn't really turn out to be a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, that was the protected hamlets of Vietnam. That was the protected camps of Rhodesia. So, I mean, that's again, there are very real historical comparisons to this as well. So that's not too far out there. I want to ask, so you sort of alluded to it. This is kind of a weird question for an ahistorical game like what you've got. One of the things that I always ask the coin guys, and Brian Train gets mad at me for asking him this with all of his game designs, but when you go through, for instance, A Distant Plane, when you go through Liberty or Death, when you go through a lot of those historical coin games, and you look at all the event cards, those are all ripped straight from the headlines. You're going through and you're going, yeah, well, that one happened on this day, that one happened on this day, that one happened on this day. But what you don't see very often are things that could have happened but didn't. It's very rare to actually get a card in there. You go through Liberty or Death, like literally every single card in that deck happened somewhere. And you ask, well, what if something different had happened? And the answer you'll get is, well, just don't play the card. Well, that's a dumb answer, right? You know, give me a card that could have happened but didn't, and let's see how that changes the thing. So something that you mentioned, you know, you've got a lot of those events that are straight out of the show that you could probably skip to that scene in the show and go, here's that show, here's the event card that goes with it. How many event cards did you put in there, or how did you get around to creating the event cards for things that could have happened, but there is no direct place in the show that you can point to that's a, there it is.
Well, probably the better way to think about with our event cards is that the event cards give you the freedom so the events could play out differently. So some event cards, like the one we just mentioned, you know, you follow it to the T. But other event cards, they're going to trigger an event, but where and how it happens can be different. So it's not necessarily going to be that we have an event card that is going to be a hypothetical new event. It's just, it's going to change how that event plays out. Because the way these event cards work is that we have a white box, and the faction who's represented by this white box has to make that go as far as they can in terms of happening. But they have some freedom in the ways they can make it happen. And that allows them to diverge from the original series. So let's see what would be a good example of that, Austin.
Well, no, I do have another point on this, but I do want to finish this point first.
I'm not sure how, even if you pulled a specific event in there somewhere, I'm not sure how much, too much of our audience is necessarily going to know the specific moment in the story.
We'll tell the story, right? So that's where I'm trying to figure out a good one where we could tell a good story about that.
Yeah. So, geez. So I guess we can talk about Protoculture Heist. Because it's a thing that happens, because again, So there's a card called Protoculture Heist. And what happens in the show is that Commander Chiron directs some of his people to go to New Detroit City and steal a bunch of protoculture. Now, protoculture in this world is the stuff that makes things go. It's pretty nebulous as far as sci-fi stuff goes, but inside the game, you get protoculture and you use protoculture in order to make things work. Protoculture is the thing that everyone's kind of after. It's a plot device. It's a very major plot device. The alien ship that crashed, the SDF-1, that was full of protoculture, even though for the majority of the time that the humans are using it through the show, they have no idea that it's there and that's what they're using when they use it. So it's like, so it's this thing. But
it's
so,
like the dust in the dust series. It's this alien thing that makes stuff go, hand wave over it, keep on going.
Yeah, it's this spice. You need it.
Yeah.
So Chiron sends some of his minions out to New Detroit City to get this protoculture. And in the show, they are able to rob and get some of this protoculture, but they don't get very far. The RDF shows up and they take the protoculture back and the guys, you know, and the henchmen come back to the leader and like, we weren't able to do it. And he's like, fine, I guess I'll do it myself. You know, classic cartoon villain style. And he goes out there and does it. So he goes back out and he then successfully steals stuff. But we have a card that's just called Protoculture Heist that focuses on that first half. And what you're able to do with that card is you're able to take these protoculture tokens that if you think of it like the coin series, you have these economic zones that allow you to gain some extra income. Mm-hmm. Here we have spaces, but really you don't care about the spaces. You care about the token that's inside. And that's because of something like Protoculture Heist, which allows you to move these tokens. The card allows you to move the tokens around. But the consequence of which is that you move two of these tokens to a single location, but then just like in the show, all the rest of the Zentradi go back to the hideout to talk to the boss. So this is a card that shakes up the game a lot because people can be in control of these territories and think these zones and think I'm going to get this protoculture, this little extra economic boost at the end of the round. But then here comes Protoculture Heist. And now the Zentradi Rebellion player is moving these tokens around to any space where they have units on the board to try to take it and capture it for themselves.
But then now think about this, Austin. The key thing we wanted to know though here that was asked is mm-hmm. how is this allowing the story to diverge from the show, right? Because now that was the point we're making here is that these cards, while they're going to match events, the way the events play out will play out differently from the show. So like, for example, you mentioned in the show, how will the original heist go?
They got like halfway out of the city and then they got caught by the RDF and the RDF took it back to the city. That's how it went. So they were unsuccessful.
Now in this game, is that always the case?
No. In this case, the Zentradi Rebellion can move it to a little stronghold or into the wastelands that they've set up on the board and they will actually steal the protoculture at the end of the round.
So what we're really doing is we're allowing the events to lead to different outcomes. And you know how you're going to strategically move it on the map is going to let these events create different scenarios and stories than what originally took place. That the story and situation that these events created can be different. And so it's through that play of the game where you start getting that divergence from the original history.
Gotcha.
And my secondary point that I wanted to bring up is that there's another way that we allow playing with the timeline through these event cards. So whereas in a nominal coin game, you go through these cards card by card, and you always have the option of taking the event or the counter event on the card. But the way that we do it in Robotech Reconstruction is we actually deal the cards out to players' hands, and they always have an option as to what event card they're going to play. Now, unlike coin, there's not an event counter event. Each card only has the one event on it. But overall, only half of the cards get played. So from game to game, there's a completely different series of events that matter. And that's the way that I think of it, is like you can imagine that all of these things still happen as they happen in the show. But for this game, these are the events that actually mattered in moving things forward. And it really creates this interesting thing as a player when you're looking at your hand of cards. Depending on which faction you are depends on how you value the cards that you have in your hand. There are cards that, depending on who you are, you'll say, oh, this has to get played. There are cards that once they're in your hand, you go, this will never get played. And then there's a whole subset of cards that, and this is the cool thing, is that at the beginning of every player's turn, that player has the option of trading a card with another player. So you have this, so there is a whole subset of cards that, depending on who you are, you can say, I can trade this card with somebody else for either something better or to get a threat taken off of the board. Because again, there's only 30 some cards in this deck. You play this once or twice, you will get to know all the cards very quickly in this game. And so after just one or two plays, you're going to be like, I'm on the lookout for this. I'm being cautious about that. I know this can happen. I know that can happen. And you're going to either be, you know, wheeling and dealing to either get it, prevent it, or make it happen.
Chris, jump in here.
This is just a simple little question. How long a game is this? How long does it take to play this game?
It takes 1 to 2 hours. The way the game's set up is that everyone has their round where they take command. And so when you take command, you first look at your hand of cards. You decide if you're going to trade with someone or not. You're only allowed to trade one card. After you've done that, then you're going to play your event card. And the event card is going to have a faction on top of it. And that faction controls the actions on that event card. So if I play my own event card, then I control the actions. If I play someone else's event card, they control the actions. But they have to follow through on what the white box tells them they must do. So it's a white box of things they must do, whether it's good for them or bad for them. And then there's a blackish gray box where they have an optional action that they can elect to do. After that's been done, you take command. And if I played my own event card, when I take command, we have what are called special actions and normal actions. And where they matter is that if I play my own event card, when I take command, I'm only allowed to take one of my normal actions. But if I play one of my opponent's event cards, then I can take any two actions. I can take two special actions. I can take two normal actions, one normal action, one special action, and any order I want. So you have that trade-off where you do get a benefit of playing someone else's event card versus playing your own, if that's what you want to do. And after everyone does this, we have a resolution phase where everyone has a series of set actions that they get to do. We do the victory check, and some things get reset too. But at that resolution phase, if anyone's met the victory condition, the game just ends. We don't keep going. And so if you get through two rounds, and your game will always last at least two rounds because no one can win in the first round. That's a 1 hour game. Each round's half an hour. With the three of the factions, you find out in the victory check whether or not they've won or lost. For the Zentradi Rebellion, it's an instant win. As soon as they have 11 civilians off the board, doesn't matter where you are in the game, game's done. And that's why it plays so fast. It only lasts four rounds, and each round regularly just lasts half an hour when we play.
Yeah, a one-hour game is what most coin players call setup, you know. So it sounds like what you've got there is you've got the operation plus the special activity or the event, and other people get that limited operation similar to what you've got. You know, again, using the coin series as a reference point for folks. You know, I do think being able to get something in 1 to 2 hours is probably nice for more casual players. You know, you guys have a much smaller map than most of the coin games as well, so that keeps things pretty tightly focused. You know, to use the oft-referenced aphorism about Cuba Libre, it's a knife fight in a phone booth, right? It's very tight, and you can't help but trip over each other because that's just where you are in there.
Right. And even though it is only about a 2 hour game, and like we said, it's four rounds and each player gets a turn and a round, but because of that whole, I'm going to play another player's event card. Usually in a round, you get like 1.5 to 2 active, you know, you get your turn and then you get like another half activation or maybe two activations on your turn during the course of that round. And even though it is a 2 hour game, it is still a full game. Yeah. What we're allowed to do in these event cards is, compared to a coin game, we get to be pretty crazy in what these event cards are able to do because of the time crunch.
Yeah.
Right. This is a very tactical game in that sense where from the beginning of the round to the end of the round, a whole lot of crazy things can happen. A whole lot of interesting things can happen. And you always have to be thinking about what your plan is moving forward, because it will be shifting on a turn by turn basis because of how much these events actually change the situation on the board. So it is a shorter game, but it still feels like a full game. You know, you still get that full game feel when you get to the end of it.
Just confirming, there's not a lot of direct sort of kinetic action. There's not a lot of direct combat happening in this game. The combat is sort of, I don't want to say just waved away, but a lot of it is handled by those actions, those events on the cards, correct?
I mean, you can destroy other units. I mean, there is destruction. It's just whether or not is that your best move. Sometimes it is, but a lot of times it isn't. It depends.
But that destruction is sort of, there's not a lot of opposition to it. You decide, I'm destroying those units get destroyed. It's not, hey, I'm shooting at those guys have a certain defense factor, we're going to some sort of results table to figure out what's happening. No, it's just make those guys go away, and that might be good for me, that might not be good for me. I got to find out in next round. But
absolutely,
there's not a lot of, it's not an opposed action, it just sort of happens.
Yeah, the point of the game isn't to see who's the best at setting up a battlefield and winning like a division or a brigade battle. The point here is more about strategically placing yourself in the politics of the situation. I mean, gosh sakes, one of our actions is throwing a concert because it rallies people for a cause. I mean, we're more concerned about the, in essence, the political struggle with some violence around it.
Yeah.
Though I will say it makes sense for
the kind of feel you're going for.
Yeah. Though I will say that if you play as the Zentradi Rebellion and you're a little bit too timid and you don't attack people, that will come back to bite you. Because if you can't thin the field of your opponent's units along the way, they're going to get overpowered, and they're going to get to their victory condition before you're able to get to yours.
You're a rebellion, man. If you're not killing people, what are you doing? You know, I mean, that's the point. That's what you're there to do. So yeah, absolutely. Guys, with Robotech Reconstruction being out there and it's available and people can go grab, what's next? Where does this go from here? Is there a next?
I mean, right now we're still in the pre-order stage, right? We're
StrangeMachineGames.com. You can go to StrangeMachineGames.com and you can pre-order the game.
$35 link to the episode. Guys will be able to just click on that link and dash right off to it.
I mean, for us, there's really two projects, right? So first project right now is we're not from a traditional wargaming publisher. So for us, we've been having to work very hard to sort of introduce this game to wargamers because we're not from GMT. We're not from Compass. So, you know, it's just not something you're readily going to hear about. And that's really taking a lot of our time and effort. I mean, we're also spending a lot of time and effort, of course, reaching out to traditional Robotech fans. And for them, basically, we're introducing them to how to play a coin game. And so for us, that's really our biggest priority right now is that outreach, because we're not coming from, you know, for a traditional Robotech game, this is not what you see. Yeah, there's a lot of good RPGs out there. Yeah there's a tactical miniature game out there. But yeah, there's also a lot of fillers and other co-op games that are not something of this genre. And that's our primary thing. Do we have some stuff in our back pockets? I mean, you know, this game's a 3-4 player game as being released. Do we have an alpha version of a solo version? Yeah, we do. But you know, it's still alpha version, and there's no guarantee that the publisher is going to follow through with it, because this is, for them, this is the wargaming solo game. It's not something that they're primarily focused on. They're primarily focused on Robotech games. So unless they can see how they would be able to sell it, you know, it might be something we end up making and we'll be happy with it, but it may not be something we'll ever get to take to market. But we do know that, you know, if you like coin games, there's a lot of people like solo coin games, and we understand that. And that's why we have this alpha solo version, but it's.
So at this point, we got to get the first one out the door and make sure that it's a success, and then we worry about what comes next. But wasn't sure how much of what might have already been on the drawing board that, hey, get this thing out the door because there's more cool stuff coming to support it along the way.
And I mean, as a pre-order price point, I mean, I know it won't have the same types of bits and pieces as a traditional coin game, but that's why we're able to offer it at $35 plus shipping. I mean, that's the trade-off, right?
Mm-hmm.
especially for a game that's only 3 to 4 players, but it plays 1 to 2 hours and it can serve as another entry point. And it comes with some stylistic differences that we think helps with that.
Yeah.
Like if you were to look at the game design, we're very much based on iconography. We were very focused on making sure that the player's aids were easy to read. And if you were to flip them over, it gave a quick synopsis of who you are and what you care about. And that's so on one side, the iconography is for our Robotech fans who may not be used to coin games, so it's really easy for them to pick up. And on the flip side, here's what you need for a story if you're a coin player, so you quickly know what the scenario is so that you can quickly get to the part of coin that you enjoy.
Yeah. So recognizing that we're in pre-order and that there are limited opportunities to sit down and poke around with this to make a decision as to whether or not you're going to pre-order it, where can people find their own opportunity to play the game instead of just watching a YouTube video or listening to us yammer on here on a podcast? So by the time this podcast goes out, things like CompassCon and HistoriCon are already well underway, if not in the rearview mirror. I know WashingCon is coming up in March, but that's probably too far away for a pre-order campaign that is going on right now. Where, if at all, can people find this thing if they want to give it a whirl before making a decision to commit?
Strange Machine Games Discord. So we'll also make sure you get this link, but if you go to the Strange Machine Game website, you can join the Strange Machine Games Discord channel, and we will happily match you up to do a teach and play using Tabletop Simulator so that you can learn this game and you can play it and see if you like it or not.
Okay, so we've got TTS going on that folks can get a chance to play. Look, the Dragoons are very familiar with TTS. It's a little funny. COVID hit and suddenly everybody went, oh my God, what do? We got to start learning how to play it. We'd been doing TTS sessions for a year before COVID ever hit. Even more than that, if you go back and look at when Saturday Night Fight started on our site, it was over a year before COVID hit. And so when everybody else was running a tabletop simulator, we just sort of shrugged and went, all right, we're going to keep doing what we've been doing because we'd been doing this for so long. That was just a normal thing for us. So
I mean, if you want, we could stop by and do a game of Robotech Reconstruction for one of the Saturday Night Fights.
Yeah, so folks looking for Saturday Night Fights or Wednesday Night Warfare or Thursday Night Throwdown or any of those others or a special one-off with these guys, we've got that area in our forums specifically set up for organizing some online games. We do have the Dragoons Discord as well that some folks are in. That there's an online game section in there for folks looking for stuff. We've always got folks willing to sit down and sling dice over just about whatever it is we're trying to pull together. I know our boy Cyrano is sort of the ringleader on Saturday Night Fights and has stuff planned going out for the next 6-8 weeks at least. But as a one-off, you know, certainly throw your hat in the ring in there, and I'm sure we'll find some people in there. We'll have a thread opened up for, hey, come, you know, get a look at this game and see, you know, what kind of takers we've got in there as well. I'm sure we can find some folks that would be interested in giving it a whirl. Just didn't even know that Tabletop Simulator was an option or if there were events going on in either of the locations where you guys are physically located. Now that people are starting to tentatively get back in the same room with each other to play, if there were any, you know, set up options for that yet.
If things keep going well, we will be at PAX Unplugged.
Okay.
So that's the plan. Strange Machine Games has a booth at PAX Unplugged. And like I said, if the things are going well enough for PAX Unplugged can run, then Austin will be there demoing the game and help you run games and showing you it so you can try it out. With a physical prototype version. It won't be the final version. It will be the prototype version.
Yeah.
But that's the thing we do know it's on the schedule that is coming up not that far away, really. I mean, it's what? It's November now?
It's a month off. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a month off from now and even sooner when this releases.
By the time this releases, it'll be mere weeks away. Chris, any last questions you can think of that you want to throw at these guys before we call it a night? Yes.
I don't think I have any questions. They did a pretty good job of covering the waterfront, as near as I can tell.
Oh, so we've got the link in the episode here for folks to be able to go get their pre-orders in. We will have links to opportunities to hop online and give it a play so that folks get a chance to hop on TTS and give it a play with these guys. And so if you've got questions, thoughts, comments, concerns, you'll know where to find these guys. And These two, as one merged brain, are also very active on Twitter as Dr. Witz over there on Twitter. So you can you never know for sure which one of them you're talking to, but they're there. You've got them available. So that's all there. Aaron, Austin, thank you guys very much for showing up for the show tonight. We really appreciate it, and wish you guys all the success in getting Robotech Reconstruction out there to your audience. And I hope this goes well.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And Chris, thank you for jumping in at the last minute and helping out here. Definitely appreciate that. And then for the update on where Atomic Rockets is going right now.
Thank you very much. It was fun to join you tonight.
Yeah, appreciate it. And so, audience, thank you guys very much. Coming up, upcoming episodes, as we're on the downhill side going towards the end of season 7 for the podcast. You know we're going to do something on the Charlies because we have to. We can't help ourselves. We're also going to have an episode coming up on sort of wargaming news and kind of options and ideas and places for where you can find as much of that as possible. And we're probably going to do some holiday episode where we just all get drunk and make fun of each other, because, you know, we haven't done that in at least, I don't know, 6 weeks or so. But definitely appreciate you guys joining us for the ride here. And we'll catch you on the next episode of Mentioning Dispatches.